Why the hell do you play a bard?
Welcome to A Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy, a podcast about geek culture by lawyers with your hosts, Ben Siders and Kurt Damon.
And welcome back to A Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy, the podcast that asks interesting questions that don't have any answers with your host, Ben Siders. That's me. And the other guy is Kurt Damon.
As always, it's Kurt as the captain of the Enterprise.
We are intellectual property attorneys and certified geeks practicing law in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find me, Ben, on Twitter at Benjamin Siders. And you can find Kirk at KirkDMN. And this podcast is also on Twitter somewhere.
Well, it's on X,
it's
I
on
guess.
X. on X Twitter. So today's episode, we're doing this thing, if you haven't noticed, where we kind of do fluff episodes on off weeks from regular episodes. This episode's going to be a little bit of both. Our regular episodes get into some substantive law on interesting geek property issues, and the fluff episodes are mostly us talking about Star Wars and reviewing things. But today we're going to blend these concepts, because we're going to talk about perhaps the most litigated IP out there, Dungeons and Dragons. Which, if you didn't know, if you're living under a rock, a Dungeons and Dragons movie came out last year, and by all accounts, I think this way, so does Kirk, it was pretty good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun movie.
So we're going to talk a little bit about kind of the background of how this movie came to be and why after that disastrous film with Jeremy Irons in 2000, if you saw that one, well, first of all, normally we say if you haven't seen it, go see it. We're not going to say if you haven't seen it, don't. It was bad, but we're going to get into kind of how that came to be and why it took so long to get to another D&D movie, particularly given the kind of the broader social context that D&D seems to be more popular than ever.
Yeah, I think it's become more popular. I mean, we're also going to, I think, talk a little bit about Dungeons and Dragons, maybe some of our own interactions even with it a little bit. But yeah, I think one of the interesting things about this is why did it take us so long to get a D&D movie? And why did we get such a different D&D movie compared to, you know, the one from 2000, which I think we would both agree, you know, well, I can't say it's, you know, truly not worth watching because you can always waste 2 hours of time doing anything. It's better than watching paint dry. Might not actually be a movie really worth spending your time or your, you know, your $3 in Amazon fees to rent.
Yeah, it's we'll get into that towards the end. I think we'll probably try to give like our substantive thoughts on the movies as film. So we'll talk about that. But to start with, we actually, before we sat down to record, we looked into a little bit of how this movie came to be.
Dungeons and Dragons is role-playing game released by Gary Gygax and his company at the time. I'm trying to remember what it was. It wasn't TSR before originally.
It was like Tactical something.
Something or other.
The original version was called Chainmail. It was him.
That was
and,
a board game.
And yeah, and was it Anderson was the other guy? They're both from Wisconsin.
Him, yeah.
We did a whole episode about this. We talked about the original set of litigation over Dungeons and Dragons 2nd Edition. Yeah. So we'll try and link to that to the show notes.
But basically, we have that being created as a game back in the 1970s. It sort of becomes iconic. I think, you know, for any of the people growing up in the 80s, you encountered this as a game. It was a game. There was an early television show. I definitely remember sort of.
It was a cartoon, yeah.
Yeah, cartoon animated show on Dungeons and Dragons, which was pretty good from what I remember.
Yeah,
writing.
And if you're, that one is worth watching. It was basically about a bunch of teenagers who play D&D and go on a D&D ride at an amusement park and then get sucked into the actual D&D world.
Yeah.
So they come from a world where D&D exists and then they wind up in it.
It's kind of Jumanji, I guess, in many respects.
Yeah, so
a
little bit of that.
D&D, I think without any questions, Dungeons and Dragons, D&D as it's commonly called, has become a bit of a cult status. Everybody kind of knows what it is in many respects, at least in certain
Stranger Things kind of amplified it. If you didn't know what it was, yep. They played D&D first edition in that.
Yeah, and so I think it's up until probably, you know, the 2000s, it definitely was more of a cult type of thing.
Yeah.
You had to kind of be involved in role-playing people or really nerdy groups to know what it was, but it's become more popular recently. And with a lot of properties, things are starting to be licensed out for movies, for video games, for stuff like that. There were some very successful D&D video games, even early, original Baldur's Gate,
Neverwinter Nights.
Yeah, you know, which were, those are settings, by the way, in Dungeons and Dragons. But yeah, I think it's a property that's been licensed out a lot over its time because it has kind of an iconic name, if nothing else.
Yeah, definitely a very valuable property and truth be told, probably underutilized in terms of licensing opportunities. And then maybe due in part to sort of the ambiguity surrounding the IP rights and as we discussed in our last episode about the open gaming license, it's kind of tricky to figure out what exactly they own. Like, they own the books, obviously, but they don't, you know, it's hard to own rules, and generally copyright won't protect that, and we know it's not patented, so.
And for purposes of something like, you know, making a movie, we don't care about the rules. I mean, you know, the character's not going to be rolling dice, you know, in conjunction with it. But what you really get into, I think, with it is it's also, in sort of getting to one of our older episodes, D&D was designed to be a generic version of Tolkien, so we bump into the, how much of this is sans affair of just fantasy, Mm-hmm. You know, there is nothing unique about a dungeon. There is nothing, you know, copyrightable about a dragon, so to speak. You know, I mean, other than a specific dragon. So what we're in some sense talking about, the name Dungeons and Dragons and the association specifically with Dungeons and Dragons in that particular name.
And D&D also has challenges the same way that Tolkien does, in that a lot of the names that they use for things are not names they came up with. Now, the names themselves are not copyrighted, but if you take enough of people's original names of things, at some point you've used it enough that it looks like you copied. But, for example, Tiamat is like the most famous D&D dragon, the five-headed dragon, but that name comes from Babylonian mythology.
The hard part you have in conjunction with everything Dungeons & Dragons is arguably Dungeons & Dragons is the archetype of what is fantasy.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that it falls back on it's the sense of fair of what fantasy is, it's not protectable. But at the same time, everybody knows Dungeons and Dragons is a specific setting. And so you kind of bump into this double-like thing where you look at it and say, it is both sort of the basic, you know, core base upon which fantasy will be judged, while also being its own unique enterprise and its own unique setting, you know, with it, which is also where you bump into things like Baldur's Gate with Neverwinter Nights, specific locations within Dungeons and Dragons, Greyhawk, you know, those kind of things being, okay, those are more specific. What do you really have for licensing and how do you deal with these kind of things? Again, versus making a generic fantasy movie. I can go out, I can make a generic fantasy movie that involves a dragon. I can write a book that involves a dragon. There are thousands of them published every year. You do not infringe upon Dungeons & Dragons intellectual property by simply having a dungeon or a dragon.
Or both.
Or both in something which you generate. So therefore, I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, part of the reason I think you have these issues around this is, one, the ability to call it Dungeons and Dragons. And then there are unique aspects and elements of Dungeons and Dragons which are specific to Dungeons and Dragons and potentially getting aspects to those, which may also influence what you use in your presentation, which is something I think we're going to get into in conjunction with the movie.
Let's talk a little bit about the background of this. And this we found this in a Hollywood Reporter explanation of the lawsuit that was settled almost 10 years ago now.
Yeah, it's a little hard for us to get true legal documents on this because a lot of them are going to be just court filings.
Well, and it goes way back to, and a lot of this stuff is old, and a lot of it's private contracts. So as best we can tell, at some point in the 80s or 90s, a unnamed company had acquired the, we call it an option, but you can buy the right to make a movie about D&D if you want to. It's called an option contract. You don't have to make the movie, but you basically paid money for the right to buy the rights later. Kind of like trading stock options is kind of the same way. You don't have to actually exercise the option, but you have to pay money to preserve the right so nobody else can do it.
No, I'm not an entertainment lawyer, but my understanding is this is very, very common in all forms of entertainment. You know, it happens all the time in movies and music. You know, you option songs, you option things with it. In many respects, it's probably how a lot of these artists get paid, quite frankly, is option contracts more than things ever actually getting made. But it does give you the right to do it, to say, yes, I want to make this, I'm going to, and I'm holding that right option. I mean, option contracts exist in patents and all forms of IP
as
well. So they're common.
They're helpful, too, because you can buy the option for a relatively small amount of money compared to actually licensing the IP until you can pull together for a film. You got to get together a producer. You got to get together financing and everything else. So you may find out that you buy the option and then you can't get you can't pull together the scratch to actually make it happen. So, you know, better to let the option expire and lose that money than to pay for a big expensive IP license you never use.
And I think a key thing about it is the option, it is an option to buy in the future. So you pay for the option and that money's lost regardless of whether or not you make the object usually. And then you pay again to actually get it once you're happy with it. So yeah, for a movie that allows you to find a director, find actors, find a script you like, and determine things like that, to actually make a movie you'd be comfortable with making and paying the full license fee, which will be substantially more expensive than...
Well, it helps you get that stuff together, too, because if I'm the producer and you say, hey, I'm going to license the rights to make this movie, I'm like, okay, tell me when you actually license them, then I'll talk about whether I'm going to put money into funding this project.
Yeah.
Whereas if you say, I've got the exclusive option rights for the next 5 years, okay, now I know you're serious, you've got something more than nothing. So this is just how these deals get done. So anyway, some company had optioned the rights to make a D&D movie. We don't know what the company's called, don't know exactly when, but those rights were acquired by a company called Sweet Pea in 1994 for $15,000.
Obviously, at this point in time, the thing about D&D is still very much, and you know, I'm in college at this point in time, it's still very much, I mean, nerdy pastime, it's niche.
That option led to the 2000 film that we keep dunking on. The film was made and released. It was a commercial flop. It was a critical flop. Even those of us who were really excited to go see it were like, boy, that was just not awesome.
And again, I think a lot of us grew up on that Dungeons & Dragons animated cartoon that was quite good.
Yes. So the movie was not successful. Despite that, there were also option rights to sequels. Two more films came out. There was one called Wrath of the Dragon God that went out on the Sci-Fi Channel in 2005, and a third one called The Book of Vile Darkness, which came out in 2012. Awful.
Well, I actually have to admit that it said that one was released on the Sci-Fi Channel as well. I thought that one actually got straight to video, but I may be wrong about that. You know, but I'm presuming a Hollywood Reporter knows better than I do.
Yeah, so they've investigated this more than we have.
But yeah, one of the things to keep in mind is, my understanding is, the reason these additional movies come out is a lot of times an option, you can maintain an option to make more movies, so long as you make the movies and present at least a certain minimal effort in doing so. So one thing to keep in mind is that oftentimes movies are made and released to television or released straight to video, which are not intended to make any money and are not necessarily intended to be any good, so to speak.
Yes.
They are intended to keep that option right alive while you work on trying to potentially do something else or sell it off to somebody else.
These things often say, once you've optioned the rights, you have to make the movie in a certain amount of time or you lose them. So nothing says you have to make a good movie.
Or in some cases that you have to release the movie, as has been known for certain other movies.
We covered the Fantastic Four movie that was never publicly released. Okay, so what happened is those movies got made. We don't have the details of it, but at some point, Hasbro, it appears, believed that Sweet Pea's option rights had reverted back to them, and then they then optioned it to Universal Studios.
I believe part of the reason was there was an assertion that the sequels were not actually sequels under the contract.
Yeah, that was
so
part of it.
Was that caused the option to reverse?
Yeah, they basically, we haven't seen the court filings, but we think they argued that because they were not theatrical releases, they were not quote unquote movies, they were just television programs, and so the rights had reverted back to them.
That's an important thing, actually, just to talk about, is keep in mind, we're in the 90s, television and movies are very different at this point in time to the way we think about them today. So you can definitely have this kind of a dispute. If somebody said you have to release a movie could have meant at that point in time a theatrical release in a movie theater, not a made-for-TV movie, not a straight-to-video, depending on what these contracts said.
Yep. So at this point, as far as we think what happens is Universal thinks they've got the rights, Hasbro thinks they've given the rights to Universal, but then Warner Brothers gets involved, and this is where it gets interesting. They, and I think you guys will be able to relate to this, somebody wrote what we would just call the equivalent of a fan fiction script. Didn't have the rights, didn't own any rights to prepare the script. But
now they're paid for this by Warner Brothers.
Yeah, but they brought the script to Warner Brothers and said, hey, we think we've got a good script here. The author was David Leslie Johnson, who also wrote Wrath of the Titans.
Which is a pretty good movie.
So Warner Brothers commissioned this screenplay, really fell in love with it, and they went to, we think, Hasbro and said, we'll give you $5 million for these rights and 5% of the gross. But Hasbro, of course, said, can't do that. We already made a deal with Universal.
Yep.
It was at that point that we think Warner Brothers looked into it and said, wait a minute. No, you didn't. Sweet Pea.
Yeah.
Sweet Pea still holds these rights. We're going to go to them. And so litigation shenanigans ensued. The case went to trial with all these parties being involved. There was a 6-day trial held, after which the judge apparently told the parties, y'all need to work this out. You don't want me ruling on this. And after months of negotiation with no judgment, they came to some kind of undisclosed agreement under which Warner Brothers would finally be able to make this movie.
Yeah, and I mean, we have no idea what that agreement is. You know, we don't know whether or not there was a thing with it, but in many respects, what was probably being looked at by Warner Brothers here was enough of an agreement that they wouldn't get sued, recognizing that effectively if Hasbro says, hey, we're not going to sue you for what we license to Universal, Universal probably should sign off, but even if they don't, they may have a weak case.
Yep.
You know, and that's the real interesting thing, I think, to point out about this is that we have four very large, very sophisticated movie studios. Well, it's three very large movie studios, but four sophisticated movie studios who literally don't know who owns what at this point in time, going to trial, and a judge that sort of says, look, you guys sort it out because you don't want me sorting this out, either because the way I look at it, it's going to be a mess for all of you, or because the fact that I don't really even want to figure it out on my own because it's too much of a mess. When we talk about the idea of, you know, law being complicated, it's not like these guys don't have lawyers. It's not like they didn't look into this with a great amount of detail. This is what happens. Things get complicated.
This all boils down to, as far as we can tell, what does that option right say that Sweet Pea bought for $15,000 in 1994? Presumably the option contract was written before that. We did a whole episode over how unclear contracts can be even now, much less written then.
Especially our last episode talking about the Open Gaming License. When we talked about it in that episode, hey, you know, the hard part with this is how do you interpret these things? This is exactly the same problem. You know, potentially part of this was when this was written, what was a movie is different than what a movie was when it was being litigated in
2015. This was being done.
You know, we have no streaming when this thing is written. You know, cable TV is still relatively new. You know, yes, it's been out since the 80s. You know, but it's not that much of a sort of established thing. The concept of serialized TV show, you know, watching like what you'd watch now being released on Disney Plus of anything Star Wars we talked about, doesn't exist.
The division between TV program and movie used to be very clear.
Yeah.
But it's not now. Is Stranger Things a 12-hour movie that you watch 1 hour at a time, or is it a TV show?
Yeah. To sort of jump on and pick up one of my sort of favorite, you know, shows is what it is, Babylon 5, which was really kind of the first serialized science fiction television show. That's the late 90s. You know, that's the first time this has ever happened. So, I mean, we're in a contract that was probably written before the concept of really anything more than a two-part episode of TV even existed. So, again, when you bump into it and say, are these things sequels? Are they movies? You can see where potential disputes rely upon this. Now, again, we have no idea what action this was over because we don't know what the contract says. These are all, you know, sealed court records, and a lot of it's discussed behind
doors.
Possibly
we could dig it up if we go to look at the trial record. Who knows? But
it doesn't matter for our purposes here. What we're just kind of trying to point out, there's a long, complicated history, and in the end, Warner Brothers ends up with rights that they think they can make a movie with.
And they do, and what's interesting about the movie is that it uses the D&D name, the branding, the trademark.
It's called Dungeons & Dragons.
Called Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Amongst Thieves. But the story and the film itself don't use a whole lot of what we would call the core of D&D's IP, which is the game rules, the mechanics, the extent they have IP, as we talked about in the last episode. It's not clear what all is covered there. But there's not a lot of that, because it's a movie, right? We're not going to watch a movie. It's not like Stranger Things where we're watching people play Dungeons & Dragons.
The character does not make a charisma roll to determine whether or not they succeed. The script tells them whether or not they do.
but it is set in one of the settings. It's Forgotten Realms, I believe, is the setting. That's the setting that has Baldur's Gate and Neverwinter. What's it called? Neverwinter Fortress? So it's got all those things in it. There's a lot of throwaway references to stuff that if you know the setting, and I don't actually know it that well. I was a big Dragonlance fan. I've never read a single Forgotten Realm book. Although if you play D&D and if you were involved at all in the D&D subculture, you know who all these characters are. You know who Dordain is and all the drow and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, my problem is I also knew Dragonlance and I knew Greyhawk.
Greyhawk I knew better too. Yeah. So anyway, it's set in Forgotten Realms, and that definitely is a form of IP that, as we discussed in the last episode, they have rights to. That is creative. There's the stories, there's the characters, there's art that goes with it. Yeah. There's a lot more there that is easier to say, okay, this is something that they clearly have some rights to, and that has to be licensed to make this film.
Yeah.
And that may be why they chose to set it in like a specific universe, which is already familiar to people who want to see the movie, whereas the first one, I think, was not set in any particular universe.
That's one of the things that's interesting when you sort of bump into this is it's what's the value of setting this in the Forgotten Realms, you know, in these cities which are known to be D&D cities, but which, let's face it, anybody who's not a big D&D fan is probably never heard of it and knows nothing about. Now, part of that can be because of the fact that since they own the rights, they know they can use them. So why don't they use them? And there's a value to do it to saying that, of saying, since I own the rights and know I can use it, I'm going to use it. One, because it keeps me within my license. And two, it means I'm away from anybody else. I'm not going to potentially bump up into somebody who says, actually, you bump into my, you know, completely unrelated dragon story, which happens to be set in a city that looks like your city. No, the city here is Forgotten Realms. It's a well-established Dungeons & Dragons sort of, you know, area. It works.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of thing. And so that's another thing to keep in mind with these licensing rights. When we look at it and say kind of what's associated with these licensing rights, some of it is defensive as well.
Let's talk briefly about how some of the, probably not the legal decisions, but these choices influenced how these movies are different.
Yeah.
There's two things I think are very different. One is that the first one is not set in like a really recognizable universe. I haven't seen it since it came out.
I
do not remember it like having any, you know, I had some D&D trope, like the Beholder, I think, was in it. But it didn't strike me as being tied to a Greyhawk setting or any of the major settings, whereas this one clearly is. Also, the first one took itself very, very seriously. The protagonist took the story seriously, took the subject matter seriously. Everybody was playing the material very straight. This one is not like that. This one has more of an Ocean's 11 type feel to it, where the protagonists are all already aware they're going to win on some level. Like,
yeah,
it's kind of got a tongue-in-cheek, elbow-to-the-ribs feel to it, where they're in on the joke.
I think the one thing that this Dungeons & Dragons movie did really well is it has the feel of a Dungeons & Dragons campaign, which from anybody who's ever played Dungeons & Dragons, you're supposed to win.
Yeah.
You know, somebody might die along the way. You may lose a character. But ultimately, you're usually successful in a Dungeons & Dragons campaign. You don't usually fail. Now, yes, you can.
You can. That's the point.
You know, that's the point. If things do happen. Things do go wrong. Sometimes failure is interesting. But a lot of times, even in failure, you create a story under a Dungeons & Dragons game. Because this is a scripted movie, you can look at it and say, there is a story which will be told. There has to be, because that's kind of what it is. And in this, the characters are kind of aware of that, of this. Yeah. We're part of a story which is being told. The ending's already written. We don't really know what it is, but we're pretty sure we're going to be okay with it.
And what works really well is that, it's inherently silly, right? I think one of the problems fantasy movies have is that it is hard to deliver the dialogue convincingly and with a lot of seriousness as an actor. The material is inherently silly. You're in front of a green screen. The stuff you're dealing with is not actually there. Kind of like the Star Wars prequels. It's just an inherently silly subject matter. And if you play it too straight without a sense of humor, it just doesn't come across. And we saw that with, like, how straight the prequel Star Wars movies were played. There was no humor or levity to it, whereas the sequels kind of played the material out in a little bit more of a lighthearted way that works better with the nature of the
subject. Now, that's not to say can't play fantasy series.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones. The one I'd throw into it, because I think it has some D&D moments to make it into later, Witcher, which I've started watching on Netflix.
But it still has a sense of humor to it.
It has a sense of humor, but it also does play the universe very serious. Yeah. I think the hard part you get into, and it's interesting because I've been listening to some podcasts recently talking about, you know, movie scripts and movie producers and things like that. And, you know, one of the things that was said, and it was by the director M. Night Shyamalan, who I happen to particularly enjoy, was the comment that he said, you know, genre has an advantage that you can use the genre.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a great comment of what it is. When you're in fantasy, you can use the fantasy, but you've got to figure out how you're using it. And that's where you can make it very serious and say, no, I'm telling a story about the, you know, trials and travails of power, which is what Game of Thrones is. I'm just telling it in the fantasy universe so I have aspects I can use. You can tell what is this Dungeons & Dragons movie by saying, I'm telling a story which is slightly tongue-in-cheek about exploring a fantasy universe, because the story is the fantasy universe in some respects itself.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we don't need to tell a story of the interaction so much between these people. I think if you were to look at Dungeons & Dragons and say, what is the human interest in this story? There really isn't one. The human interest in this story is a standard trope.
You're coming to see it for one of two reasons. And the main reason is going to be either that you're a big D&D fan or fantasy movie fan and you want to see it. And the other reason is that you're dating somebody who is and they drug you to it, right?
Or you also happen to, I think there's a third reason, which is you know what Dungeons & Dragons is and you want to learn more about it.
But the movie, if you haven't seen it, first of all, I haven't seen it, go see it. It is worth your time.
It's definitely worth your time.
It's 2 hours of the screenwriter winking at you. You know, like
there is a plot. It's a basic fantasy story. But yeah, there's a lot of wink, wink, nudge, nudge going on in conjunction with it.
It's very overt. Yeah. Like, there's a great scene where one of the characters, they're talking about how to use some magic item. I think you can resurrect the dead and you can ask them five questions. She's like, well, that's an oddly specific number, but that's how the D&D rules work. Like, it has to have a number.
And that's, to get to the point, I think, you know, we can use that as a jumping off point. If, you know, one of the things I talked about is the idea of specifically using the D&D rules. The D&D rules of why it's five is because it works in a game system.
Because it's balanced. It's fair. Like, you have to have a number.
But it also makes it fun for purposes of kind of picking on that, because in the real world, it doesn't really make any sense. Why the hell do you play a bard? Because it's the most useless character to ever have in a D&D campaign. Because you're not useful in the vast majority of the campaign, which is in the dungeon, which involves combat, which involves survival. The bard is the character that makes the most sense to be the traveling person that is the core of D&D, but makes the least sense as any D&D character. And so I think one of the things you always discover is in most of these D&D properties, one of the characters is a bard, which is itself kind of a tongue-in-cheek, wing-wing, nudge-nudge, which is also done done by The Witcher. I just sort of pointed that out. You know, sort of things that, you know, the other main character in there is a bard. And so it's, that's something I think is really, you know, when you get into that, it's hard to avoid that. Because if they didn't include a bard, if it had just been, you know, the fighter or the magic user, you kind of bump into the, well, is it D&D? You know?
When they did a nice, this is where I thought the screenplay was the strongest, is that if you've ever played D&D, you know that it's mostly lighthearted. Yeah. It's supposed to be fun. You know, when you're an adult, you drink a bunch of alcohol. When you're in high school, you might still drink alcohol. But you drink a bunch of Mountain Dew and you get some donuts and you put Mystery Science Theater on and you play a D&D game. At least that's what we used to do. It's lighthearted and fun, but inevitably there are, as in the law, ambiguities in how the rules work that lead to sometimes very serious, not funny arguments. And some of what happens in the screenplay is reflecting those arguments. So the scene we just talked about where they get to ask the dead five questions. Yeah. Okay, somebody said, I forget how it goes, but somebody says something that could be interpreted as a question, and the dead person considers it one and answers it.
Yeah, they're like, that then falls over dead again.
Yeah, they're like, well, that shouldn't count as a question, but that's kind of a, that's the kind of stuff you wind up arguing about when you're playing D&D. What is a question?
Yeah. And again, that's some of the little playful pieces behind it. There are, if you guys are sort of into it, you're really into the key topic, there are movies which are done as jokes, making fun of people doing live action role playing, being in universe and now fighting over those types of questions. So, you know, you have the Dungeons and Dragons doing the wait, which spell actually goes off first? And it's, you know, that's something you'd argue about as a game player, but it's not something you argue about in a movie script. But yet you do argue about it, and that's the sort of joke they have there. Wait, is that a question? And if I remember rightly, it's actually the, wait, is that a question? They ask the dead, the guy's like, yes, it is, and that's another question. And so, you know, those kind of things with it.
On the flip side, they also have the situation where they only asked him four questions and then walked away.
Well, the fourth question, that's the after credits scene, is a bit of a spoiler, is the guy who's only been asked four questions sitting in his coffin going, doesn't somebody want to ask me another question? You know, because he's still animated and he hasn't died yet again. And again, kind of poking fun at that, you know, what does it mean to be five, and that's oddly specific. There are a few other things they do with it where it's the, we need this particular helm. Wait, why does it do that? You know, it's because you need something to go find.
Then the paladin, you know, the paladin is like the paragon of virtue, and they've got this gorgeous man who there's like halos and stuff around him. And
He walks on water, can do no wrong.
He's good at everything because the paladin was so overpowered in D&D.
Yeah, and a lot of it is in D&D, and I think the thing in D&D is you needed the core for the storyline because it was a game, because you wrote your own stories. There were lots of tropes that got developed in conjunction with these. You know, there were a lot of, you know, things that you just kind of had to deal with to make the D&D campaign make sense. When you bump into a movie script, you don't need any of these because the story is written. The story is pre-written and you know what the outcome is going to be. You know what all the dialogue is. You know everything along those lines. But if you're going to write it in D&D, you still kind of have those aspects. You know, if you're going to refer to the helm of whatever has to operate the same way in the movie as it does in the game, or else people are going to look at it and go, but that's not the helm of whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you see these, you've seen jokes about it. I know in an earlier episode you mentioned it, Wendy's made a joke role-playing game.
Oh, yeah, we did cover that.
You know, we covered that at one point in time. These tropes are things in role-playing games, which are kind of just things in role-playing games as you have it. I have a whole series of buttons on my laptop bag right now my daughter got me, which are all D&D tropes. You know, critical failures and, you know, what does it mean to be chaotic lawful and, you know, and stuff like that, you know. And that's what makes it chaotic lawful, isn't really
chaotic good.
Chaotic good.
you probably see these things, though. Like, it's entered the popular consciousness. I was on Reddit the other day and somebody posted a meme. It was a picture of somebody doing something good, but kind of in a wild way. I can't remember what exactly it was. But the comment was just, chaotic good. Finally, if you ever wonder what chaotic good is, this is it. This is somebody who doesn't care about the law, but is doing good anyway, like a Robin Hood type thing.
Yeah, and I think it was one of those where, you know, a lot of this has kind of entered, we get where it comes from. And again, it's game rules. But when you start saying, how do you apply game rules to a movie, they don't necessarily make any sense. Because again, a movie has different rules. It has a script. You know, I always joke about it, once you start filming Star Wars, we all know how it ends. Every actor has read the script and knows how it ends. Mm-hmm. They know before they say an individual line in the movie, everything that's happening in the movie. But we sort of accept that, but we don't. It's why you can make movies with these incredible strings of coincidences. The example I always use is The Manchurian Candidate, which is an incredible string of coincidences have to happen to make it an interesting story. It's an interesting story because all those coincidences happen.
Yeah, movies work by getting you to suspend your disbelief because you do know on some level, obviously, that these are actors on the screen. You know, yeah. Chris Pine is in this. I know who he is. I know he's not really this character, right? But they've got to act well enough that I'm not thinking about that, that I'm convinced that he really is this character, at least for this bit of time.
Yeah.
That's why Tom Hanks, I think, is such a great actor, because he's so famous. But when he plays these characters, I'm never thinking while I'm watching the show, it's just Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wrapped up in the story. So they ride a very fine line here of winking at you enough that you get that you're, you know, that they know that you're in on the jokes, but not so much that it shatters your suspension of disbelief.
Yeah. And again, I think that's when we say that, like, this Dungeons and Dragons is a good movie. I think that's the reason why we say it is because it does do a nudge that you overlook the weirdness of the story, like the thing with it, because it's made funny.
The dragon is fat, right?
Yes.
There has to be a dragon in the Dungeons and Dragons movie. And to avoid it being a boring cliche, they make the dragon fat so that he can't fit through the dungeon.
Which is great, because it's the other problem you always bump into if you ever play Dungeons and Dragons, dragons are rare.
Yes.
But you need a dragon in a Dungeons & Dragons movie.
And you need a dungeon. So they put them both in the same place, and they made the dragon too fat to fight.
Yeah, and so they just run away from it, basically, you know, and sort of escape it.
Which makes sense, because you could never beat the dragon. Yeah.
The same as they kind of make the paladin the clear NPC that shows up with just the right things at just the right time. You know, happens to be the character they need to bump into, which is the way you advance the plot again in the game is, hey, I'm going to introduce this NPC, which does get you what you need. I'm going to introduce this MacGuffin, which gives you something to go find.
Yes.
You know, that kind of stuff. It all works. And again, it works because they play with that. Whereas if you take it as a truly serious fantasy movie, you kind of can't have that game aspect to it. It wouldn't be a Dungeons and Dragons movie.
No, it would feel out of place. It would feel forced. It would be it would not be believable. Like, you know, in Game of Thrones, we had 4 or 5 seasons before we got to a full grown dragon. The writers made the audience and they made the story earn that to be able to have it. If you just start out where they've already got a dragon, what's like, you know, it's like watching Jaws and you see the entire shark in the first scene. All right. Now I know what the big bad looks like, and the rest of the movie is not that interesting because it's your imagination along the way that provides a lot of the entertainment.
Yeah. And also, and again, Game of Thrones, I think, is a great example to compare because Game of Thrones is also based on a very long novel series, which still isn't done, even though the TV series is. But, you know, you get this kind of thing where you can say this is a big, well-developed universe. The rules within that universe have nothing to do with gaming. You know, whereas D&D is a well-established universe, but its rules are all based on gaming. It's what is the aspect of the character? What is the profession of the character? How do spells work? Because we need to figure out what gets cast first.
Well, that's important in fantasy, too, because to do genre fiction, you have to have rules for how the universe works, and you have to follow them. Or people, even if they don't realize it, you can sense when something is inconsistent and not and doesn't make sense. And when that happens... It suspends your disbelief, or it shatters your suspension of disbelief. So in some sense, it's easier for D&D because the rules are already written, but they're written to play a game that don't necessarily make sense.
Yeah, and not to write a movie. So I think you want to move a little bit, just sort of talk about what we thought of the movie as a whole, you know, generally what we thought of the movie and stuff like that. So I think we both like the movie, you know, generally what it is. One of the things I come in with it is I like the wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I also like the fact, quite frankly, and I think the most memorable scenes to me were the ones that were really poking fun at Dungeons and Dragons directly. It's exactly the scene we mentioned with the graveyard, where it's the, wait, why is it 5? And then it's the, we not only have to go dig up one body, they dig up like 30 before they can finally figure out what they want.
Yep.
Because they got to find the right person. And of course, they have no idea who in this battle is the appropriate person to dig up.
And it completely looks over the sort of the inherent grossness of excavating a bunch of rotting corpses. And they are gross. They look decayed and gross. But the whole scene is played with levity. It's fun. The questions are silly. They establish that tone right away. And it also helps you to not get an R rating for something like that, to really balance that the tone and the visual style carefully. So that's, you know, that helps a lot. I think another thing that's important, you have to balance the sense of humor and the lightness of the protagonist and their side of the plot. You still have to have stakes.
Yeah.
If we don't feel like the characters really care about what's at stake and that they're actually in some kind of danger, then it's not really a movie. It just doesn't seem serious. The dramatic tension is gone. And in that sense, I thought it reminded me a lot of the tone that was struck in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, where the main characters are all just a little bit silly. They're all kind of caricatures or stereotypes themselves or archetypes themselves. But the villains That's the same here. The villains played the material very straight. They had very serious, ambitious goals that were very bad for everybody. They wanted to kill and murder and maim and do all these things. And they played the material straight. And even when the main characters are interacting with them and doing so in a way that involves some humor and fun, the villains were never in on the joke. And I think that's important to balance that out. And I think that's why that works.
Yeah, and that's... In many respects, I have to agree with you. I think the movie works because it is stakes. There are some dangers to it. They also give some real human elements. I mean, the recovery of his daughter.
Yeah.
That this is important to him. You know, things like that. But it plays with the levity, I think, where it's the levity in some respects is to just deal with the how we get through, for lack of a better term, MacGuffins, which is, this is a movie of getting MacGuffins because that's what Dungeons & Dragons is. You have to go get this helm so you can open this door so you can get this treasure chest, which gets you this book, allows you to actually do what you're intending to do.
It kind of became a meme for a while amongst role-playing games, the Rod of Seven Parts, remember that from the first edition? Like, there's always something you have to get the thing, to unlock the thing, and I mean, that's just video games, right? Video games kind of borrow a lot of these same tropes of how you structure the plot to give people immediate accomplishable goals that then unlock the next goal.
And what's cool, I think, in Dungeons & Dragons is they do that. There's probably four or five real plots as part of this. Every one of them is quite different and allows them to tell some little sub-movies, like the dungeon plot with the dragon in it and stuff like that. This stuff is specifically associated with the paladin. The sort of, even the end stage is kind of its own. You know, the Colosseum scene is kind of its own separate plot. You know, I think you get all these kind of little small stories in it, each one of which is to get you something, and that something allows you to advance to the next plot.
Didn't they have some portal, too, that they found that they could set up and walk through?
And, you know.
I like that, too, because those things are dangerous to introduce into a story like this, because if you're very, very smart, you can find some ingenious ways, ingenious, unintuitive ways to use that to great effect. And I thought they did a better job of that. There were some scenes where they were moving the portal to certain places that felt like somebody actually sat down and walked and kind of thought through how you would use something like that if you had it, as opposed to just saying, I need a MacGuffin to get me through to the next part of the scene, and they were going to forget about it, even though it would make sense to keep using it.
Yeah, and they also, I think, played around a little bit with, that was where some of the lightheartedness was, is the, why do we need this MacGuffin? That was, I think, the thing that was most interesting, you know, and that was done early on. Like, he goes and he gets the helm to unlock the door, which doesn't work, you know, and that's sort of one of the big aspects of it is it's, wait, we had to go get this thing, which actually isn't helping us. Why did we do this whole quest? I mean, you know, and that's, I liked that about the movie. And again, that's a little bit of the tongue in cheek. The one thing I think you really did see, and I think was interesting about it, we commented about the dragon. You could definitely see them sort of poking a little bit of fun at, we need to have the iconic Dungeons & Dragons character. You know, we have a Beholder, not really talked about that much, but it definitely appears. We have a gelatinous cube, you know, not really talked about it much, but it does kind of appear. You know, those are kind of, in some sense, iconic, more D&D characters that are associated more with D&D. Now, I think the gelatinous cube has kind of moved out of that.
Yeah,
you have the slimes, you have things in other
slimes
things
have all
like
become
that.
Kind of tropes after D&D that they're in all these games now.
But, you know, definitely the Beholder. I don't think anything else really has a Beholder. And at the very end, you know, because we have to, we're going to have an owlbear, which is probably the most iconic D&D monster there is probably the owlbear. You know, which when you think about it, is the most illogical, like, chimera
in existence. It makes no sense at all.
I mean, there's a lot of weird chimeras, but, like, that one makes no sense. But yeah, it's those types of things where that's what I thought this movie did. That movie did really well.
Well, they also had a nice like orchestrated dungeon homage. There's that scene where they're thrown into that arena where like all the walls come and go. And that was like a nice chance to have a little stage controlled area to just rapid fire throw a bunch of stuff at you. The mimic chest is in there.
Yeah.
Like all these D&D tropes. So like if you've ever played, you've definitely run into these things. And I know they just wanted to get that in there. Kind of like, It's all fan service, but unlike Star Wars, where like the story still has to have a plot, and the sequels kind of didn't. This one still has a plot, so throwing in this kind of fan service as just like a side element to it, as opposed to the movie is about the fan service, I thought worked a little bit better.
Yeah, and actually,
because they're winking at you throughout, so you know it's kind of.
I think the arena also worked because in many respects that's the way you design a dungeon with miniatures. Is you're constantly kind of putting down the pieces of the dungeon and shuffling them around. I mean, so yes, you're on near to confined to a tabletop, you know, doing the dungeon as to what it is, but that's kind of the dungeon of Dungeons & Dragons, even though we'd also had a real dungeon. But yeah, that's what I enjoyed about it.
It was well cast.
It was well cast. It was well acted. And again, I think it's because they took seriously what they needed to take seriously. They didn't take seriously what they needed to not take seriously.
Yep.
And again, particularly the villains did a great job of being very serious, even to the point where right at the very end, it kind of, you kind of get a bit if they're still too serious, like they should be on the joke by now. And it kind of falls a little bit right at the end.
Yeah, I would say that's probably the weakest part, is that the motivation and goals of the villains, I don't remember it very well. I just remember getting to the end and being like, I understand they're fighting these people and that they're bad. I remember there's like a red cloud that like
she's trying to like turn everybody into undead or yeah. something. I don't remember what it is. But she's getting everybody in so she can cast the curse on him. I remember that much. She's casting a curse. I just remember what the curse does.
I just remember not finding that the villains overly compelling. They were kind of really generic and two-dimensional, which is fine. The story isn't really about fighting and overcoming the villains. I mean, that's the overall plot. But the narrative arc for the characters is about Chris Pine's character coming to peace with the fact that he's, you know, finding his daughter, coming to peace with the fact that he's lost his wife.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is just kind of it's meant to be kind of a fun roller coaster ride through a world and a universe that you've wanted to see done well on screen for a long time. And in that sense, I thought it was pretty satisfying. Yeah. It could have been a little bit stronger. I like that there's always a big fight at the end, and I always call it the big dumb fight. Because by that point, the plot is over. I know they're going to win. And so it's just a question of how. But these fights just go on and on and on and on with no real stakes and no real story momentum or cleverness to what the people are doing. It's just orchestrated violence. This one wasn't like that.
Yeah.
The fight was over relatively quickly, kind of in the way that an old school, like,
you had a bunch of sort of different smaller fights too.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Like Hugh Grant's character was a coward and trying to get away, and mm-hmm. But like the main fight with the big bad really didn't go on that long. It was maybe 5 minutes. Yeah, that's enough.
Yeah, and it's a fight that's convincing is the way it occurs, because there's treachery in it.
Yeah.
There's, you know, a lot of sort of, you know, smart thinking. There's things that have been referenced of going to happening, you know, you kind of have the, you know, the prophecy coming true in conjunction with the paladin, you know, sort of that, you know, or statement by the paladin is not a prophecy, it's what he has to do. But those kind of things sort of, you know, it's, you kind of did resolution, but you resolved it really fast. And I think where it comes to, and I remember hearing this again, sort of in another, you know, like discussion with movie directors, where they say, eventually you have to show the monster.
Yeah.
And in this one, they showed the monster, and then they very quickly went, yep, now that you've seen the monster's kind of boring, so let's get rid of the monster right away and get back to the whatever happens next.
Yeah.
And that was good. It was a whole lot of lead-in to not showing the monster. And then when we showed the monster, it's, okay, now the monster's boring, let's kill it and move on. Which, interestingly enough, the most interesting thing I sort of compare that to, having, you know, encountered recently, I read Stephen King's It. The battle with It is 30 pages of, you know, a 1,000-page book, you know, I mean, you know, stuff. And that's the same kind of idea, is it's, what's great about that book is the massive lead-in to what it is. And once you see it, you're kind of like, eh, kind of whatever.
It's almost always disappointing, right?
Yeah. And the monster's never as good as it is, as the threat of what it is. And there's a lot of movies that never resolve the monster. But in something like this, you have to resolve the monster.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And they did a good job with it.
And it's really hard not to. I think one of the best horror stories I've ever read was Edgar Allan Poe's The Pit and the Pendulum.
Yeah.
Because all you know is that there's a pit, and there's something in the bottom of the pit that the narrator finds so horrifying he can't describe it. And we never find out what it is, but that, you know, not knowing what it is way worse than knowing.
Yeah.
So it's one of those rare cases where the point is to not know, and it makes it all the more unnerving. Yeah. So
there are authors who do that particularly well. They tend to be horror.
You can get away with it in writing in a way that you can't in a visual format.
Yeah. I mean, as a movie that does it, one would have, I would arguably say it's something like, it's zombie movies. It's 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
It's Night of the Living Dead, where the zombie issue is not resolved. You just end up with this particular aspect of the zombie issue being resolved. Now, Night of the Living Dead does kind of resolve it, because essentially the police are supposed to have killed the zombies, yep, or hunting them down. But the whole point of that isn't the zombies. The horror is not the zombies, as sort of pointed out repeatedly. Whereas in a lot of those kind of movies, another one to think about is I Am Legend is another sort of good one, where it's, you don't resolve the horror in the end in many respects.
Yeah, like he's got a cure, but we don't know what's actually going to be deployed. It's going to fix everything in the world, you know.
Surprisingly enough, another one, just having mentioned M. Night Shyamalan earlier, I know it was a movie that was not as popular as, but I actually really enjoyed, was The Village, which does show you the monster at the end, but then you kind of realize that the monster isn't the point.
Spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it. Isn't that the one where the monster is just the villagers?
The monster is the villagers, but the whole point is why the villagers are the monster.
I know, but that's one of those, oh, the monster was us all along. I did not. It's like a lot of his stuff.
But it's not that the monsters, to me, it's not that the villagers are the monster that matters. It's why the villagers are the monster.
I know. Shyamalan, to me, is kind of in the Abrams category of great at setting things up, but doesn't really know how
I really like M. Night Shyamalan. I've liked a number of his movies that other people don't. Definitely, I enjoyed that. Is it Bedtime Story? I'm trying to think of the one that's
The Lady in the Water.
Yeah.
I didn't see that one.
I enjoyed that one. I really enjoyed The Village. I actually really enjoyed The Village. I know a lot of people hated it and stuff like that. Whereas I actually found Unbreakable, which I know a lot of people adore, to be one of his not as interesting movies, quite frankly.
I haven't seen that one either.
That's the superhero one.
Yeah. All right, well, let's wrap this up. So overall, really, really well done film. It's kind of hard. D&D is tricky to do well in a visual narrative because you got to balance all these different things. You got to balance the fan service. You got to have an interesting story. And I think they pulled it off about as well as they could. I really wish we knew more about the details of this agreement, though. I assume that with the success of this film, we can expect more.
I think we're probably going to see that. My guess is, again, this was probably something to get this film released. But I've got to believe these parties are negotiating. They will work something out.
If it's making money, why would you not?
Money talks here, I assume, in these scenarios. You know.
Well, it's hard to find something that comes across as fresh when everything is a sequel or derivative of something else. And D&D has kind of been underutilized, maybe, at least in cinematically it has been. So there's an opportunity here to really expand and then build on this. Like Dragonlance is rife for exploitation. And because we do talk to Margaret every once in a while on Twitter, but there was some talk about a D&D Dragonlance movie that I think fell through and is not going to be made now. So, but you know, that's another one that someday somebody will find a way to get that put together.
I think the one problem you have with D&D is it's, in many respects, D&D is the butt of a lot of jokes. Yeah. You know, there's lots of things that are out there. My daughter and I have started watching, she reads the manga, we just started watching the anime for Delicious in Dungeon, which is basically turning Dungeons and Dragons into a cooking show. If you haven't watched it, by the way, it is a great show. It's really entertaining. It's very fun. But it's very tongue-in-cheek about what the idea is. But part of what they do is they make fun of, what the hell is this dungeon anyway? Why is it here? And that's one of the big aspects of it is, what the hell does this mean? To the point, and talking about being a Dungeons and Dragons campaign, the characters reincarnate and come back. Like, that's an important aspect. Mm-hmm. Even though the whole reason they're doing this is because they're trying to rescue one of them. And so you kind of, you know, bump into this thing, and it's like, okay, you know. There's a lot of things out there which are effectively Dungeons & Dragons, but aren't Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah.
And I think that's the hard part you've got with using Dungeons & Dragons as a licensed property, is it's a unique property because it, in some sense, is the genre.
Yeah.
It's the creator of the genre in a basic sense, compared to what was The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings being the specifics that it based its generic genre on, which we've talked about in prior episodes. I think that's why we keep coming back to Dungeons & Dragons. This is like our sixth or seventh episode on Dungeons & Dragons. Is there's very interesting legal issues around this, and particularly intellectual property issues, because Dungeons & Dragons holds a unique place as a property. And I think to Ben's point of the fact that it's not being utilized enough is because it holds a unique place. Yeah. It should be used more, but it's also hard to do so.
It's hard to do. Hard to do well, as we saw with the 2000 movie. It's really easy to screw it up. Okay, I think we've beat that one to death. So next episode, we've got some things coming up that we're going to talk about. Our next episode will be more on the legal side, but you'll have to wait and see what that's going to be.
Yeah, we're not sure we're going to talk about it.
As of right now, we don't even know. So that's all for this time. We'll see you next time. Lauren, play us out.
The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Lewis Rice LLC, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer. This podcast was produced and recorded in St. Louis, Missouri.